And welcome to the first ever live recording of Plan Dulce. We're recording this episode here at the fourth annual Lugares Conference. Lugares is a virtual event hosted by Latinos in Planning, a division of the American Planning Association. And Plan Dulce is a podcast we started in the summer of 2021. One of the founding members, Leonora, is here. And we kind of started it to serve as a platform for Latino planners and urban planning topics unfolding in Latino communities across the country. So this is really a space to elevate projects, issues, and initiatives taking place within Latino communities across the US and abroad. So I'll introduce myself. My name is Grecia White. I am the outgoing vice chair of the division. And I am pleased to be co-hosting this episode alongside Heidi Urita Lopez. She has been an incredible support for the podcast and the division in general. She was also a panelist in one of yesterday's sessions. So stay tuned for the recording of Latinas Leading the Way. And continuing on that theme, we're also very excited to have Claudia Monterosa with us today for a chat about Latina leadership. And briefly, I just want to describe myself for folks who may need a physical description. I have long black hair. I'm wearing glasses and I'm wearing a black top with a yellow cardigan. So I will now introduce our very special guest. As Deputy Assistant Secretary for Grants Program, Community Planning Division at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, Claudia oversees affordable housing and community development programs, including the Community Development Block Grant, the Home Investing Partnership Program, the Housing Trust Fund, and Disaster Recovery Funds, in addition to department-wide energy and environmental policy. So she's quite busy, and she brings decades of nonprofit and public sector experience incorporating social justice, grassroots organizing, and equity to her work at HUD. She also served as the public policy and research director at the Los Angeles Housing Department, successfully proposing and implementing new policies and programs to help address long-term inequities in the city of Los Angeles, including advancing and implementing housing, land use, transit-oriented development, community development, fair housing, sustainable and equitable policies. Claudia holds an MA in urban planning from University of California, Los Angeles, and a BA in political science and Latin American and Iberian studies from UC Santa Barbara. So we're very, very excited to have her.
Thank you for that.
Thank you so much, Gracia. We're going to go ahead and continue and ask you a couple of questions, Claudia. And before I do that, I do want to describe myself for our listeners. Hello, everybody. My name is Heidi Urita Lopez. I'm one of the co-hosts along with Gracia. I do have, fair brown skin with brown hair, wearing a black blouse. And in honor of this Plan Dulce series, I am wearing these little Minnie Mouse Conchita earrings, supporting a small business from Arizona. Her name is Desi. It's Cositas by Desi, if anybody's interested in buying these little Conchita earrings. So with that, I just wanted to ask you, Claudia, what part of the world are you in right now? Where are you tuning in from? And have you always lived there?
Thank you for that. And thank you for the introduction. And just to tell you what a pleasure it is to join you all today. I'm very excited about it. So I'm actually in Washington, D.C. Today. I have not always lived here. I'm from Los Angeles, from Pasadena, in fact, and I made the trajectory to relocate here temporarily for this amazing opportunity with the administration earlier this year.
Thank you for sharing that, Claudia. We always like to know where we're tuning in from as this podcast reaches so many Latinos across the United States. So it's always exciting to know where we're all calling from. So if you can share with us, Claudia, where did you grow up? And perhaps do you have a favorite childhood memory that you would want to share with us?
Sure. So I have maybe a little bit of an interesting upbringing, you know, sort of historical how I grew up. I grew up, actually was born here in Los Angeles, East LA. Both my parents are Salvadorian, and my brother and I were born here. Yay. And I did actually start first grade here at Normandy Elementary School, as a matter of fact. And but my parents decided to relocate permanently to El Salvador when we were very young. And so we actually grew up in El Salvador. So dual childhood sort of memories on that front. And, you know, during that that time, basically saw the beginning of the civil war in El Salvador in the late 1970s. So I'm dating myself. And actually returned to Los Angeles with my mom, just my mom and myself, first in the 80s. And I have not been back, you know, I have been back, but not to live there. And I do have family in El Salvador, but LA is my home, you know, and yeah, so.
What a wonderful story, Claudia. And I think, at least on my behalf, and I think on the behalf of everybody that's listening in, I would love to know, like, do you have a favorite childhood memory that just brings you joy, or anything that you remember about playing with your friends in El Salvador? I know we were talking about this earlier, so I would love to hear that story.
Yeah. Sure, por supuesto, because I was, you know, in that really sweet spot in my age, growing up in El Salvador. Most of my favorite and dear childhood memories are from growing up in El Salvador, and really just having the freedom to play with my friends, stay up all night. You know, we had a lot of freedom, and, you know, really use our imagination to go into different places and get into trouble. You know, I was one of the pack leaders, you know, both girls and boys, you know, with my brother. And, you know, so I do really fondly remember that, and that we can really develop our skills and just have an enjoy, you know, very, very joyful moments. But I do want to put the sort of like the backdrop of what was happening during that time. Although these are very fond memories, there was a lot of turmoil happening in El Salvador. I grew up in the second largest city in El Salvador, Santa Ana. So soy Santaneca. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the civil war started to impact different places in different ways. It's sort of a bit, you know, it was a little bit staggered. But while, you know, the strife and conflict, you know, kept increasing, you know, there were toques de quedan, which is, you know, basically you couldn't go after 6 o'clock PM, or, you know, no earlier than 7 AM or 6 AM in the morning, you know, for some time. But when we were able to be out there, you know, we will be playing and going about our business. And then there would be the death squad, you know, really going through our neighborhood and really asking us, the kids, if we had seen certain individuals or just seen, you know, tanks or listening to, it was very traumatic. And we tried to really continue to have a sense of normalcy. Basically, we have to go about our way and about our lives, despite what was happening. So the other fond, you know, but, you know, very, you know, other fond memory is the resiliency that our people and all of us really engaged in, because we had to go to school, our parents had to go to work, we had to go about our business. And when they told us that you can't go to the schools because they would be rounding up kids, right, to, you know, to basically recruit them or forcefully include them in the, in, you know, in the fights, you know, in the armies or informal armies. So it was, the juxtaposition of that is very formative and transformational. And I take that to heart, but there is definitely really good memories in that as well that have continued to live with me because we had deep friendships with families and the children that I play with. So,
yeah, Claudia, and I want to thank you for being so candid and having that confianza, right? That confidence. We are in a safe place here, you know, talking about these things. And I think for a lot of us who have families, and maybe some of us still have families in other places, right, that we keep in touch with, these are all the things that just make us stronger. So I want to thank you and I want to commend you for sharing those memories with us. And as we move along here with the questions, I'm sure that it'll probably come up again, but we're just wondering, you know, what influenced your calling into planning, being that you had this rich experience of being in Los Angeles, going to El Salvador, coming back. You know, I'm just wondering how you found your way or your calling into planning. How was that?
Well, obviously the Civil War had a huge influence and, you know, seeking justice and, you know, access to opportunity, economic opportunity, housing and all that good stuff. And that was further confirmed or more emphasized here when I came back to Los Angeles. And it was just my mother and I, and we had to face a lot of housing insecurity, right? Habitability issues and access to really good, safe, you know, and affordable housing, which is and continues to be a huge challenge here. And then really early on during the undergrad, really got involved in education because of, you know, the same instances. So it's just something that's innate in me to be able to be of service to those that are voiceless or that have limited accesses, you know, access to opportunities. So that kind of developed really early on, the sense of justice and civil rights, super important to me. And that has been continued to be woven in all of my trajectory, you know, up to this point, and will continue to be at the core and at the center of what I do.
Yeah, Claudia. And I'm just wondering, you know, I know you did your undergrad at UC Santa Barbara. How is it that you found your way from graduating from Santa Barbara and then going into your planning, your master's degree? What motivated you to then pursue a degree in urban planning?
Yeah, so what happened there is, you know, I had no plan after graduate school. And I was very fortunate I did know that I wanted to be of service and that I wanted to work with people, community-based organizations, the nonprofit sector really called to me. Education was super important. And also just overall how cities work and housing at the really heart of this. So I actually had the great opportunity to work for a civil rights litigation firm. Very mission driven, and I actually worked as a paralegal. Wow. And an untrained paralegal, so learned on the job, and I was really fortunate to really get exposed directly to those opportunities and work with tenants. So one of my charges was to organize tenants and collect information of discrimination that they may have been facing. Going into slum buildings in LA back in the day in downtown Los Angeles and collect evidence of vermin, taking, you know, pictures and really engaging with tenants to really basically collect information of the habitability conditions of the units. And that really opened up a whole world to me as to how our family, specifically Latinos, were living in uber overcrowding conditions and living in single, you know, single units, not single, like one bedroom apartment, single units in these, you know, 8 to 7 story apartment buildings that were located where it's now the Staples Center. And yeah, that doesn't exist anymore. There's still some standing buildings, but roofs will cave in. There was water damage, plumbing, a whole sort, so whole host of different habitability standards. And I play a critical role there in being able to communicate with the tenants in their language, collect that information, translate that information into, you know, the, you know, legal documents, you know, depositions, interrogatories, and really helping the cases advance. And we were really successful in settling these cases so that people can actually be compensated for the lack of services. And some of these tenants were actually able to use those payouts to create their own homeownership opportunities and leave those, you know, those uninhabitable units. So the, you know, the plight of that was also the immigration aspect of it. So I did some other things. So I did take a time between graduate school and then work. But that really, that work along with immigration reform and welfare reform work really just said to me, you got to go to planning school and see what you can do in terms of creating, you know, opportunities to have access to affordable housing and also community economic development. And you know, make something work out in that plan. So that's how I went in there with my eyes, you know, and my thoughts and thinking that this was the right place. And when I arrived at UCLA, that is the only school that I really wanted to go to, because it had that practitioner's aspect to it, and the professors there were really, really wonderful. And I had interacted with a few of them before arriving there. So, or I knew of them. So that's how I made that jump.
Yeah. So who were those professors that inspired you to go to planning school?
Alan Heskin was one of them. Yeah. And her name escapes me, but she was the affordable housing, you know, professor.
Was it Jackie Levitt, maybe?
Jackie Levitt. Thank you. So those were the two and their body of work, because they were really much engaged in that, you know, research and impact as on, you know, tenants and living in uninhabitable, you know, situations. So
So Claudia, it seems like you have this valuable insight of working one-on-one with people, and now you were drawn to, or maybe guided to working, not working, but pursuing your degree in urban planning to possibly look at the structural systems, right? To look at these structures to see how maybe, you know, we could afford other opportunities or maybe study other possible solutions. Once you started doing that, and you know, a lot of us get asked, what do you do as an urban planner, right? Some of our family members still think, are you an engineer or an architect? And we have to explain what we do as urban planners. I'm just wondering, like, how do you translate to your friends or to your family members what you do as an urban planner? How do you explain this very multidisciplinary?
Totally multidisciplinary, because you can go to planning school and the world's really at your feet. You have the skill set that's necessary to do all sorts of, you know, or take on all sorts of career options. If you want to do policy, if you want to do actual planning, you know, if you want to do strategy, or, you know, even communications, regional planning, and, you know, really influence, you know, policy at the national level or at the local level. So I did have a hard time explaining what I was doing, but I remember very fondly with my mom that's no longer here, because she rode that ride with me as well as my now wife. And I had to really translate to her, like, okay, this is about the built environment. And that word for her was like, oh, there you go again with the built environment. What exactly does that mean? Well, that means is like, places and how we use, you know, our places for people. Because I think one of the things that was really evident to me is that we have to approach planning from a human-centric perspective. You know, as planners, our goal, yes, is to have orderly zoning and orderly policies, but those really get on the way so many times, and we're still grappling with that. So how do we slowly but surely, you know, hopefully with the political will, start to chipping away at that, so that we can have more parks, more housing, different kinds of housing, open up the housing, right? Like to have accessible housing, you know, there's planning and building codes and decisions that I've made as to how and where the funding goes is so interconnected. And so I think when I spoke to, you know, my friends and my family about it, it's like, it's about making a difference. It's about increasing access. It's about everybody being able to have an equitable opportunity to live a really good life in good neighborhoods, because it's not just about the zoning. It's not just about the housing. Housing in it of itself is, it doesn't function without transportation access, you know, without really good schools. So it's the whole of the, it's the sum of all of those parts. And I think when we talk about who we are doing this for, I think that really crystallizes, you know, the work and so why this is so such an important field, right? And how much is in the hands of planners to change the current, you know, mode of operations. So
we do have that influence, right? And some of us, we wear our mediator hats, right? A lot of us are part of different networks and different circles. And I think that, you know, most of us try to leverage that, that influence that we might have, or bridging our technical skills with the softer leadership skills. And that's one of the big topics of today as well, like your leadership style. You know, how would you define your style of leadership? Or maybe if you could walk us through maybe how you define leadership, and maybe your styles of leadership, depending on where you've been, because you've held a lot of, you know, high caliber positions. And I'm just wondering if your style of leadership maybe has been informed or changed. But first, just to get to the point, I would love to know how you define leadership and what your leadership style is.
Well, I think leadership is it's a complex, you know, I guess, idea. But for me, it's not about just because I'm a leader doesn't mean that I'm going to lead people. You are as good as, only as good as your team and those that support you, right? And then also what you do on behalf of your team to get them ahead and also represent their values, their aspirations, and growth, personal growth, as well as professional growth. And it is an evolving understanding of what that leadership, you know, process is. So for me, what's important is to have transformational change and also participatory, you know, leadership. I value every single person that's part of my team, or when I collaborate, consensus building is critically important for me. We cannot get things done if we don't explain why is it that we're doing something, right? Or like, why is it important to remove, this zoning code? What will it do, right? And then how you explain that to the public, to the community? Not only that, but how do you convince your colleagues as well? And then how do you work internally with your policy staff or your planners to formulate the right materials and the right information to make that case to your leadership? So you have to be able to lead in multiple and concurrent aspects of the work that you do, thinking about, you know, the work priorities, but also those are professionals under you. There is clerical support for you to do that. You know, there's budgets that we need to think about. So operations, things that we don't even think about, who's going to supply you with a piece of paper and pen, you know, to be able to travel or to make those, you know, take notes. So every single aspect of the work that you do is important or plays a really important role. So to me, I don't see strata, right? I understand that there is a succession of, decision making. But it's important for me, for everybody in my team to understand that they do have input in the ultimate outcome of that project. And also to recognize the work of folks. And I'm a behind the scenes kind of person. So oftentimes I just What rewards me is seeing my team succeed and being able to, at the end of the day, did we meet our ultimate objective, right? Did we make it easier for people to access their funding? Did we make it easier for people to be able to effectuate their rights? You know, did we effectively educate folks? Did we effectively succeed in removing a barrier of some sort? And that's how I count success. And that's how I think about leadership. And it's always an evolving thing. And you have to be able to manage across, laterally, vertically, all sorts of ways. And always having an open mind to be flexible and nimble, because change is part of this game.
Thank you so much for that, Claudia. I know that Grecia has the following questions, but I just want to thank you for explaining the complexity, but yet your very candid way of looking at transformative leadership and being participatory in that, but then recognizing that it takes all of us, right? And commending all your staff. I think that's so important. So thank you for that. And Grecia is next.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you, Heidi. I love that team perspective and kind of what focusing on what we did as a collective. So I really appreciated that. And you talked about consensus building and bringing people together behind an idea can, you know, sometimes be a challenge. It's not always easy, especially when, like, at the positions, at the levels that you've positions at the levels that you've held. So how have you kind of navigated that process, like navigated those difficult situations? And, you know, does one specific instance come to mind, or, you know, an example where that really stuck with you and has helped you throughout your career?
Ooh, there's so many examples of that, because I am a fighter. So I'm a quiet fighter, but I am a fighter. Heidi knows this about me. And so I think part of the trick and the key, not trick, but key, is really consistent relationship building and understanding the roles that others play in your sphere of influence. And so for that, you know, trying to build consensus, it is very, very difficult. In particular, let's just say in the city of LA, and really addressing a controversial, you know, issue. This is a little bit of a sort of like a sore, or like a, you know, interesting, very difficult situation. And it's on the community cares facilities ordinance that the city of Los Angeles considered. And this was right before the explosion of homelessness was really at the top, you know, tier level in the city of Los Angeles. And there was a consideration to ban room and boarding houses in single family zone areas. It would have restricted boarding homes and community care facilities. And knowing what my team had, you know, what we have been working on, we're like, the city of Los Angeles should not consider this move to basically pass an ordinance when we need to do the complete opposite, which is to increase, you know, supply or more access to services to special needs populations. That includes sober living facilities. And it was a huge issue that really actually culminated in raising awareness around this, but that involved the county, the Department of Mental Health, huge amounts of community-based organizations that came together to really try to educate and lift up the critical reasons why limiting boarding and community care facilities was not the opportune time to do this at this point. We were just at the precipice, you know, let's say we were at 40,000 or, I don't know, 30,000 homeless, you know, individuals by that time, you know, Can you imagine for us now trying to limit, you know, where we can actually provide services to at risk of homelessness individuals or those that have very limited means to be able to get access to services and provide housing at the same time. And it was difficult because the council at one point wanted to go one way, but the housing department, and that's something that my shop really handled, had to really work alongside the planning department and other departments in the city, as well as key community stakeholders and with the county, you know, to really understand the implications that this would have, right? So I think there was a lot of lessons to be learned across the board that were really difficult. But I think, and it's an issue that persisted for many, many years. And at the end, you know, the writing was on the wall, I think, and the issue was basically not pursued because of the opposition. And because by that time, you know, the case had already sort of been made that this would be the wrong types of policies to pursue at that level to prevent, you know, or to restrict access to these services in single family neighborhoods. And it really called to how critical zoning is in putting barriers, you know, not thinking about the implications of where and how you restrict housing and what type of housing, right? And I think that has helped to illuminate so many ensuing policies that the city has now considered to address not only homelessness, but increase the housing supply, right? I mean, it's like a gulf between that time period and what we're experiencing now. But the base, the foundation was really started there. And I think that's why where you have planners that are doing housing and planning or housing and transportation that are mission driven can really be there at the right time and at the right moment to voice those really critical concerns and do it strategically and smartly and convincing your leadership that this is the right thing to do and to also convince elected officials, mayor's office officials, you know, it's a collective of it all. And that was a very transformational issue, not only for me, but the folks that I think were involved in that policy making.
Yeah, it sounds like it definitely takes a lot of collaboration across all departments and both within like the city, but then also nonprofit or like organizations and just across all spectrums. So I guess, you know, for somebody who is interested in planning and then it's particularly interested in housing, I think, you know, how if they were interested in working more at the higher level at HUD, where they have to, you know, navigate some of these very challenging situations, perhaps. What would you recommend? What would be your advice for them?
So one thing that I do, and it's also just part of my style, right? It's for when you take on a subject, you must become as much of an expert as possible. So you read about it, you learn about it, you can speak about it at the top of your head. So it does take dedication and really hard work and understanding, okay, what is your goal here? And what do you want to do, right? So, and the opportunities may not be presented at the same time, but I think the goal should not be how are you going to get ahead, but how are you going to advance your mission and advance your core values in the work that you engage in, and also ascending through that process in a collective way, right? And there will be barriers along the way. Trust me, as a Latina, I'm often one of the few Latina women that have a place at the table. And, you know, you have to be forceful, but in a diplomatic way, and make your way in there by using policy and common sense and being ultra prepared, right? And some of those opportunities may become available and some of them may not. And I think it's, you should just be ready to be able to be at the right time and at the right place with the right information, armed with the right, you know, expertise and knowledge, skill set that will make you an ideal person to move forward, right? And so that is demonstrated by the body of work that you do. So I think also engaging in really great collaborations, you just never know who you're going to meet, how you're going to impress another person, that person, unknown person, won't make that, you know, opportunity available to you. And that's kind of how it's happened, right? So the people that you think that you're impressing may not necessarily have your back at the end of the day. And that's a really hard lesson to learn. In particular, in, for us, a lot of Latinos, you know, how we are looked at, how we come across, we are as women, we may have an accent, but what needs to come through is that, you know, your quickness and your smartness and your ability to be able to navigate really complex issues that nobody else can actually do. And that comes with preparation, right? And really understanding the issues. But you should not understand these issues in a vacuum, but really engaging with all the aspects of that particular industry or that particular, you know, that particular issue. And that's what has enabled me, you know, very organically to move, you know, basically, you know, not, I don't want to say move forward, but like to really take on those opportunities that I have either earned or have been offered to me, and then start making a difference with that responsibility, which is a big, big responsibility. What are you going to make out of it, right? So are you going to be if you do attain that position, that's, you know, puts you in charge to create policy or to move, you know, programs and deploy funding or whatever, what are you going to do with that responsibility, right? So that's the other thing and aspect of that I take very seriously. And sometimes, you know, that happens, you know, and sometimes it doesn't, depending on that, who you are as a person. But I guess to answer that question is, be diligent and be purposeful in the work that you do so that you can attain your goals and desires throughout your trajectory.
Thank you. I think that's very great advice. And thank you for emphasizing the importance of knowledge as a very powerful tool. And not just that, but also being able to communicate that knowledge to others and to very different kinds of people, you know, having a very strong handle on the topic that you're talking about, that you can communicate it to whoever, you know, in a way that makes sense to them and that gets them on your side. I think that's an incredible skill that I don't know if you ever get, you know, perfect at it, but it's definitely worth the investment in developing and nurturing. So I really, really appreciate that.
Ever evolving. If we stop learning, we don't evolve. So yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess, you know, now as you've gone, you know, farther and farther up in your career, and I don't know if you have some moments of reflection sometimes, or perhaps today when you're at the airport waiting for your flight, you have some downtime. Do you ever look back and think, oh, I wish somebody had told me XYZ when I was starting out, or I wish somebody had, you know, shared whatever piece of wisdom with me? Do you ever have those moments, and what are maybe some of those things that you wish someone else had shared with you.
There have been some of those moments for sure, especially as I get older, and you know, and I think this recent experience, you know, being appointed by the president for this particular position was one of my big desires and bucket list items. Is that I'm actually here? You know, sometimes it's really hard to believe that actually happened, you know? And I think something that I wish that I knew is that to manage my expectations. If you manage your expectations, you're not gonna set those bars so high that you're gonna create unnecessary stresses. And also to learn how to identify the people that you can actually trust, to have to basically support you and lift you up. And so to be able to surround yourself with that cadre of either friends, or professional colleagues, that I think that is so, so important for you to be able to count on that, because there will be times that you will feel completely alone. And you have to be able to have built that system, you know, in place as a support system for you to be able to continue to move forward and to remind you why you're doing this in the first place, right? And so I think that would have been helpful for somebody to sort of crystallize that for me more clearly, and to not be afraid of taking more risks. I think that's the other thing. Not to limit oneself because, you know, you're a Latina, you're an immigrant, you know, you have the perfect English that's in your mind, you know, none of that matters if you at the core, you know, are being seen by other people, reflected by your work ethic, and by your commitment to your core values. And I think that has been a revelation that has been slowly revealing itself to me, in particular as I made that jump from, you know, being in the city of LA for so long and then making that jump here. And I find that that's been, you know, learning that and realizing that has been really, really transformative.
Thank you. I think, being fearless has been a theme, actually. It was yesterday's panel with Heidi, and I love that you said that, because it's so true. And I'm nowhere at the level that you are, but it's just reminding myself of just trying things and feeling, having enough trust in myself to feel like I can do something, and then you learn along the way, you know. So that really does resonate with me and others as well. So thank you for emphasizing that.
Nadie sabe, nadie sabe todo. Nadie. Nadie, nadie sabe todo. Se aprende en el camino.
Yeah, exactly.
Having an open mind. So yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, like when you're little, you think adults have it all figured out, and then you become an adult and it's like nobody knows what's going on.
That's right.
Exactly. Well, we're beginning to kind of wrap up. This has been so lovely. I guess, you know, is there anything that we haven't asked that you would like to share, specifically like with maybe planners who are just starting out in their career, or maybe, you know, people who are kind of interested and maybe did their undergrad in something else but now want to you know, consider pursuing a master's degree in urban planning to make that career change? Any kind of advice like that you may have?
Well, I love the planning field, and you know, I'm not doing planning per se, but I have used and will continue to use my planning, you know, experience in policy, and I love policy. Who knew, right? So I couldn't have gone to policy school, but no, I'm glad that I went to planning school doing policy because it's policy and planning. But I love really working with young planners, young undergrads, and also most importantly with grad students because they're closer to getting to the next level of the career path. And I've had the privilege and honor to really, you know, be able to have mentored or really help guide several grad students in my work and in the planning department. And some of them are doing amazing work already. And also I'm working some of the young planners in the planning department and seeing them grow and flourish so tremendously. And it's also, you know, really amazing to see that. And I always look at Heidi because, you know, I've known her for a very long time and she has been just flourishing and has such an incredible impact in the work that she does every day that she is now influencing and really mentoring other planners. And I think we need so many of us out there because the skill set is really, particularly as it becomes very evident that a lot of the work that we have ahead of us, it is rooted in fair housing barriers. And a lot of that is rooted in zoning and planning, which is our work. And I think we have a lot to do on that end. And that impacts transportation, that impacts education, that impacts housing, it impacts climate, it impacts health, open space. It is the intersection that I'm looking at. And I think planners are uniquely positioned to be able to do that once they select. At a big scope, at a regional scope, it can be an incredible influence that planners can have to really, to really address over 50 years or plus more years of, you know, really putting restrictions on who can actually have access to opportunity. And a lot of that is being realized because not now for housing, affordable housing, just in general, it's so difficult for somebody to become a homeowner that, you know, ever eroding American dream of becoming a homeowner. And I talked to a lot of them, my younger friends, and, you know, it's like, what are we going to do about that? And what does the future look like for us and access to that? So I think really delving into these policies and being in government and being a public service or being, you know, working at a nonprofit, or if you are doing some private, you know, work or, you know, for-profit or nonprofit development, to be able to do that for hopefully the right reasons, which is to resolve a social, you know, very human problem that we are facing, not just here in the United States, all over the world. We're lucky that we are able to function and to be able to discuss these at length, and that the consciousness is really changing, right? There is a movement in terms of the consciousness, a lot driven by the younger generation that doesn't have the same access points that we had, even though we might have been there at the forefront in the beginning. There was less of us. We need more of us, you know, to be dedicated to this because we have those connections with our communities and the experiences. A lot of us, you know, as immigrants, that we had to translate, you know, for our parents to understand how the world works here in the United States, right? And I think we're at a inflection point in the country where never in my wildest dreams that I think that at HUD, the federal government was going to be issuing grant funding to address, you know, barriers to affordable housing. And under this administration, that has become a reality. And it's amazing that I get to do that and get to really help plan and, you know, successfully launch the first NOFO of that kind. And then seeing the level of interest that we've seen in that competition, I can tell you that 45 states are represented in the application submitted for that Pearl Housing application. That tells me the country is really ready to have this conversation. And where are the young planners going to be able to effectuate that change? So the work is really imminent right now, and we need to, the planning field needs to continue to plan and to get all of us planners in these really particular places, specific places from all aspects. So I think I love the planning field, and I love the way the new planners and older planners have made the way for us, especially, you know, we're talking to, amongst our Latino, you know, colleagues here. And I think we should not forget also our other colleagues from other, you know, underrepresented groups as well, and just really joining forces across the board with all sorts of planners. You know, change is really, really difficult. And some older planners, you know, or older folks, like I know in my job now, there are a lot of career people that are really rooted in the way things have always been done. And that's the mindset that I think is really difficult and a challenging way to move us ahead. But I think we need to be really, really intentional to be able to change and to communicate that change, right? I mean, I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, no, thank you. It's going to take all of us for sure, and across, generations and across ethnicities and races. And so, there is a lot of work to be done. I'm excited to see what the next few years look like. Thank you for sharing that fact about the 45 states. That's very encouraging to see. So I appreciate that. And I think maybe Heidi has one sneaky last question that she wants to
I have in. A funny, last question, because this is the Plan Dulce podcast series. This is something that Leonor taught me. And we end with this really fun last question. If you were to have churros and chocolate, what is your favorite churro? Or, you know, maybe what's your favorite plan dulce or pan dulce, pardon me, or anything else that you just love?
Sí. So I love plain churros, just the churros y con el chocolate.
Okay.
So amazing, and I love churros. And favorite pan dulce, pues son las orejas, orejitas. Eso es lo que me gusta porque son crunchy.
They're crunchy.
And I really love the taste of that. And the second best is la conchita.
Oh.
So, of course, la conchita.
Yeah.
And,
you know, I know we're ending now, but something else that I learned, and I learned from Vidal, is what are your favorite places to eat when you do come to Los Angeles and visit from your place of work?
Pupusas.
Of course.
Pupusas, I mean, I think I love them, and I can't have them all the time, but, you know, Salvadorian food is excellent and very tasty, and really proud that pupusas have made it, are featured in many, many places, and you can find them all throughout. And obviously here in DC, there's a huge contingency of Salvadoreños. And I still need to find my way to a good pupuseria here. But in LA, there's several spots. And I always make it a point to have some good pupusas.
Oh, great tips. now I want some lunch, some pupusas. thank you so much, Claudia. This has been absolutely amazing. We're so grateful for how generous you are with your time. And really enjoyed learning more about your planning journey and or policy journey, I guess, as well. So thank you so much. And thank you to everybody who was able to join us today. This is the first time we've done this. So really appreciate you being here within the audience today as well. And to those who may be listening across our other platforms, once we upload this episode, consider maybe joining the Latinos in Planning Division. You can find more information at planning.org/division/Latinos. And And you can also leave us a review. We're, you know, trying to grow the podcast, and so we really appreciate you leaving us a review. That also, you know, helps other people find us as well. And with that, we wish everybody a safe weekend. Claudia, safe travels. Thank you again. Heidi, thanks for being a great co-host. Really appreciate you. And yeah, take care, everyone, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you, and what an honor. Keep up the great work, you guys.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.